All right, ladies. Up, 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 up.
Hey, this is Jason Albert, and if you've already heard this podcast episode, I'm actually just refreshing it to include the Nordic Nation title. I'm doing this so the episode is available on the iTunes feed. Okay, on to the episode. Elite cross-country skier Chris Freeman turns 36 this October. Freeman isn't exactly old man winter when it comes to the sharp end of a distance race. He's a 2014 Olympian, and he's still a threat at any Super Tour. His legacy as one of the U.S.'s most prominent cross-country skiers was cemented long ago in 2003, when he placed fourth in the 15K Classic at the Val d'Ifeme World Championships. Lightning struck twice. He placed fourth again in the same event at the 2009 Liberec World Championships. In this episode, Freeman discusses those races, how he has managed his type 1 diabetes as an elite endurance athlete, and the fact that he'll be 38 when he finally retires. But first, let's roll back to the beginning. Tell me how long that you have been cross-country skiing.
I've been ski racing since I was 5 years old. I've been pursuing it professionally now for 16 years.
It sounds like you're a newlywed.
I am a newlywed. I've been married for 3 weeks now.
And your wife's name is Amber. And what does she bring to the table in terms of bringing balance to an elite athlete like yourself?
She's a former Nordic racer, and she coached development at Maine Winter Sports for 3 years. And she now works as, I'm not sure what her exact job title is now, but as a development, she works in development with NENSA. So she definitely understands the life of a cross-country skier. It's great balance. Just overall quality of life is much higher with her.
And you guys plan on staying in, I think you live in Thornton, New Hampshire. Are you guys planning on staying there for the foreseeable future, at least through 2018?
We actually moved 4 whole miles last year, and now we live in Campton, New Hampshire. But yeah, we're going to stay here for the foreseeable future.
I'm just curious, anything that you would want to talk about that you haven't addressed that having to do with type 1 diabetes?
Diabetes in itself is a pretty common disease, but most people think of type 2 diabetes when they think of it. And what I have and what most children with diabetes have is type 1 diabetes. And they are two entirely different diseases with similar symptoms. Type 2 diabetes is basically is insulin resistance. The body still produces insulin. However, it no longer can utilize it efficiently. If you think about insulin and sugar as a lock and key mechanism, and once the lock and key go together, they can go into the muscle cells and you can absorb glucose. When you have type 2 diabetes, those two, the insulin and the sugar, basically bounce off each other in the bloodstream. Type 1 diabetes is a autoimmune disease similar to thyroid disorders or any other autoimmune disease where the body attacks and kills all its insulin-making cells. So it has nothing to do with lifestyle or diet or any of those things like type 2 can. So it is, in its most simple form, I no longer make the hormone insulin.
When were you first diagnosed with that?
I was diagnosed about 3 months after I had moved to Park City. It was in the year 2000. I had raced for 1 year at the University of Vermont, decided that I was too focused on skiing to really benefit from going to school any longer, and I took up an offer from the U.S. ski team to support me training full-time in Park City. And 3 months later, during a routine blood test from the ski team, you know, checking mineral counts and cholesterol and all those things, my fasting glucose was twice the normal level.
Prior to that blood test and those red flags, were there any sensations that were different that you can recall when you were exercising or just hanging out?
As I look back, you know, some of the classic symptoms of type 1 diabetes is urinating a lot. Because the body will try to get rid of it, the excess sugar that it's not using through urine. Also, it can affect your vision. It can make your vision a little bit more blurry because there's too much sugar in the veins behind the eyes, which can also make you feel lightheaded. Now, I experienced all those things, but on a very minor level. It's that my blood sugar is twice what it should have been, but at the same time, you got to realize that a lot of people get diagnosed at 10 or 12 times what they should be. So I was caught relatively early in this, in the progression. Also, when I was finishing up my second semester of college before going out to Park City, I didn't really train the last month I was in school because I was trying to catch up on everything. And I actually thought I had mono because I felt so terrible. And what was happening is my body was still making a very small amount of insulin. You don't get type 1 diabetes and just wake up one morning and not have any insulin. It's a slow killing off of the insulin-making cells. And exercise makes you more sensitive to the small amount of insulin that was still in my blood. But when I stopped exercising, I felt horrible. But then once finals were over, I just was like, well, I feel horrible, but I'm going to start training again. And I instantly started feeling better because the small amount of insulin went further, if that makes sense.
Did you have the, because you felt better when you were exercising, were you one of these folks that had a propensity to kind of overtrain because you just felt better when you were training more?
No, I wouldn't say I had a propensity for that. I mean, I was just going from nothing to 3 hours a day was, or, you know, 1 hour to 3 and 4 hours a day was definitely enough to make me feel better. I didn't think that, just because I felt good training 3 hours a day didn't make me think I needed to train 6 or 7.
I just was kind of thinking, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I could see myself thinking that, wow, I feel better when I'm exercising, so I better do more of it.
Well, you know, I didn't actually put 2 and 2 together until I got diagnosed with diabetes, and I thought back, I'm like, oh, I felt horrible because my blood sugar was probably through the roof that whole time. And, you know, I'm a stupid college kid. I don't feel good. And I'm like, oh, I need vitamin C. So you drink a quart of orange juice, and that would be the wrong thing to do when you have type 1.
Is there, you know, and I know a lot of this has been documented. Back a few years ago, Zach Caldwell would write up really detailed blog posts about how you guys were going about working to control your blood sugar, and you would have blog posts as well. And is there anything, just looking back now, that you would do differently about treatment? You know, I mean, there's not a lot of people, at least that I'm aware of, that are at your level of sport and, I suppose, manage this.
Well, you know, that was one of the very disappointing things when I started researching the disease, was that there is basically no literature on elite level endurance athletics with diabetes. Everything that I found was how to finish a marathon, not how to win a marathon. And as you know, as an athlete, that's two very different things. Simply, you know, moving yourself 26 miles versus moving yourself 26 miles as fast as you can is a totally different physiological demand. So, yes, if I could go back in time, there's many things I would do differently because I basically had to learn through trial and error. And, through consulting endocrinologists that do have some expertise in exercising with diabetes. But for the most part, it's been, you know, paving my own road as far as figuring out how the body reacts. I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, I am missing an essential metabolic hormone, and I'm trying to replace it with a synthetic hormone that is nowhere near as precise as the body is. You know, for instance, a person without diabetes eats 15 grams of carbohydrate and the body just knows how much insulin to put in. And it can take in all the other factors that affect it, like your glycogen stores, your stress levels, how much sleep you've had, what the glycemic index of the food is that you just ate. Whereas I'm trying to do it with a synthetic version of insulin that has to be absorbed through subcutaneous fat that doesn't reach peak action for 45 minutes after it's injected and then stays in the body at a low level of activity for 3 hours. So it's been a long, challenging process to figure out the best way to manage.
You know, advice for the next skier coming up the ranks with type 1 diabetes?
I think learning as much as you can about physiology, learning as much as you can about diet, and, you know, finding doctors that believe in you are the keys. For sure, I am not doing everything perfectly, and I know that. I'm sure it can be done better. I just haven't figured out how. On the positive side, treatments for diabetes, better insulin pumps, continuous glucose monitors have gotten light years better, even in the 15 or 16 years now that I've had diabetes. So at the progression that it's going, I'm hoping that it will get a lot easier to manage in time. There's a lot of promising things in the works, and hopefully, you know, the next type 1 diabetic Olympian has way better tools than I have right now.
So here's the burning question. Are you retired?
I am not retiring. I plan to ski through the 2018 season, and at that point, I'll retire. Right now, I still enjoy ski racing, and I know that if I retire, I'll never have a chance to compete at the elite level again because I'm getting older, and I want to go as long as I possibly can. And I think 2018 is it.
And how old are you right now?
I am 35. I'll be 36 in October.
So I'm assuming that the main objectives, if you're skiing through 2018, are a world champs nomination and an Olympic nomination. Is that fair to say?
Those are both things that I'd like to achieve, yes.
Is there something you might do differently in this next run-up in terms of training or maybe trying to, you know, managing the diabetes that keeps you optimistic?
Well, one of the things that I've found is that leads to poor seasons. And last year was one of my poorest seasons. I never felt like myself last year. Whereas the season before, I actually felt very good for the first two-thirds of the season. I mean, for what it's worth, I won eight NORAMs and Super Tours before going to World Championships and getting sick, and then I never felt like myself again that year. My preparation for that season was actually really light. I didn't train that hard for me that year because 2014 had been such a hard season that I was just backing off and trying not to overdo it. Then, of course, last year, I decided that I wanted to absolutely nail it, and I started doing a lot more intensity than I usually do, and just my body never responded to it the way I hoped it would, and I felt terrible the whole year. What I have found is the more I tailor my training towards studies of normal physiology, the worse I ski. And I'll give you an example of that. So, you know, common training practice with Norwegians, for example, is that they very rarely go longer than 3 hours. They'll train, you know, 5 and 6 hours days, but it'll be broken up into two sessions of 3 hours and 3 hours or 3 hours and 2 hours. That makes a lot of physiological sense if you're not diabetic. But for me, controlling my blood sugar for one session and then recovering and controlling my blood sugar again for another session and then have makes it a lot more likely that I have a blood sugar problem in the second workout. And a blood sugar problem is very difficult to recover from. And then I compromise my entire day once I have a problem. So the reason that the Norwegians don't go longer than 3 hours generally is because, in theory, it takes a lot longer to recover from a workout longer than 3 hours. So it's better to break it up into two. But if you're me, and the chances of messing up the blood sugar is so high that you're going to end up in the toilet, a lot of the times it's better for me to just do an over distance workout. So I might do 4 over distance workouts in a week and only 2 double sessions in a week. And the more I approach my training that way, the more positive results I am getting. The other thing that I have found is doing a lot of short, hard intensities, for whatever reason, just tends to make me tired. Whereas doing longer steady state work and time trials is a much more effective way to make me fast. And I've noticed this trend by going through, you know, decade and a half of logs. I'm very interested in physiology, and I read all the studies, and all the studies say that doing short, hard intensities and breaking my workups into two sessions every day should be the way to go, but it doesn't bear fruit for me.
So how long are those steady state type sessions?
Generally an hour. And from a non-physiological standpoint, it teaches me how to relax, and it teaches how to move quickly in an efficient way. From a physiological standpoint, if you read any of, you know, the studies that Jim Galanis puts up, it would basically say that you're wasting time. But for whatever reason, it makes me fast. And I obviously respect Jim Galanis a lot, and I read the stuff he puts up, but some of those studies haven't worked for me.
You're sort of the old man, and I mean that respectfully because you're still racing quite fast. But when you show up, it's like, I'm sure most of these guys at the Super Tours had your poster on their wall as kids. How do you perceive all that?
I don't think of it too much, to be honest. It reminds me, though, that once I stayed at Simi Hamilton's house in Aspen, he wasn't there, but I did an altitude prep there before a World Cup in Canmore. And I was staying in his room, and he had my poster on the wall. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of awesome. And it makes me realize that there are people that look up to you. There are people that look at you as a role model, and you sometimes you're like, oh, I hope all my behavior has been appropriate. And then some of the things, you know, and you go back through your head and you're like, it makes you want to be a better role model for sure.
When were you cut by the U.S. ski team, and, you know, how did that impact you from, I guess, the spectrum, you know, financially and goals and just emotionally, how did you deal with that?
I was cut about a week after Spring Series in 2013. Emotionally, I was really surprised. I mean, I hadn't had a great season, but I did have a 1 point FIS race. If you look at the FIS points and the World Cup distance points, there was only one skier that skied faster than me that year that didn't get named to their respective national team, and that was Chris Andre Jespersen of Norway. So I was the second best skier in the world to not be put on a national team. So that really stung, especially how long I had been with the team. I do know they use, you know, some mathematical equation of some sort to determine how you're going, and I had certainly plateaued and was maybe going down the other side, but I was still very surprised, especially going into an Olympic year. And I was, of course, determined to not let it affect me, but it did, and it made me want to, you know, of course, prove everyone wrong. And that's a very dangerous cycle to get in because it's easy to overdo it. And I've seen many people do it. I mean, Tad did it that year because he got cut. I've seen Morgan Arotola try to do it. It definitely is a blow. It's a blow to your psyche. And so, yeah, it really sucks.
How long were you on the team prior to that?
Well, it depends on how you measure it. I was on development squad from the time I was 16. I was under true support. I was named to the A team going into the 2003 season, and I was on development from the time I was 16.
Okay. So that's like a big chunk of your formative life at that point.
Well, I mean, it was the only way of skiing that I knew. So, you know, coming up with a different support system on an Olympic year was pretty difficult.
In terms of support system, how do you coin whatever team you're on? Is it Freebird or Team Freebird? And why did you kind of develop your own entity rather than join like a pre-existing group?
Well, I skied with Maine Winter for a couple of years until their elite program dissolved. And at that point, I didn't want to join another team. I do a lot of diabetes advocacy work in the summer and fall, so I'm already traveling a lot anyway, so I didn't really want to have further obligations. And, you know, rather than just saying I didn't have a team, I just made up Freebird, which has been my nickname since I was a ski jumper as a kid. So there is no Freebird team other than myself. So, and the staff that it works for Freebird is the ones that I can get to come and help me. And generally it's the call calls.
Back in 2003, you were fourth in the world championships, and you were again fourth in the world championships in 2009, both in the 15K Classic. You know, how do you look back on those results being so close? You know, we talked over the phone, you know, and we talked about some of the specific, you know, the Estonians that were on the podium during that race. When you look back on those results, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm 100% sure that Andres Verpalu was doped. I think he was doped throughout his entire career, and I've got no problem saying that publicly. I think it's an absolute crime that he still gets to go to the World Cups today and work as a staff. I think he's an embarrassment to the sport. Aside from that, I look back on those races as a couple of my best performances. They came on the right days, and it would have been nice to have been a couple seconds faster and have a medal, but at the same time, they were fantastic races, and I don't have any regrets.
Do you think you have a top five performance at the World Cup or World Champ or Olympic level in you now?
I think it would take a little bit more luck at this point. The sport has changed a little as time goes on. I mean, as I look back in 2003, I was on the forefront of more modern technique, and now as I went to the World Cup last year and I saw people double pulling, I was like, oh, I'm missing something right now. And I've been working really hard to try to catch up and double pull. You know, the race in Liebrich, where I was fourth, that was a crazy wax day. And though I was fourth place in that race, there were a lot of good skiers that were taken out by not having very good skis that day. In a scenario like that, I can see it happening again. So if someone was to ask me, what was your best race of all time, I would probably say it was the next fall in Kusamo, where I was fourth place in the World Cup on a straight-up extra blue day, because all the best skiers in the world were there and no one was at a disadvantage.
I'm assuming, you know, most elite athletes were following the events this summer, with specifically the release of the McLaren report, I think in mid-July, and, you know, accusations that Russian skiers and biathletes and were doping in Sochi. Being someone who's been in the sport for so long at the international level, did any of that surprise you?
The apparent levels that the doping decree were coming from was pretty depressing. My suspicions had been that, yes, they'd been cheating all along. And so, no, I wasn't surprised in that sense. I was just surprised at how high up the levels it was going, how governmentally orchestrated it was. And I think, you know, that's cultural. You talk to some people from some nations, and they just assume that everyone in sport dopes. And you know, I sit there and I'm like, no, they don't. I don't dope. I would never dope, and none of my teammates would dope. But then, you know, they point to USA Track and Field, and you're like, well, yeah, they dope. So I find the state of international sport right now, I find really depressing. And I don't see it getting better unless the World Anti-Doping Association gets some guts and puts in lifetime ban for blood manipulation, for steroid use, and Olympic cycle bans for stimulants. The penalties have got to be way more severe, because right now it's just a literal slap on the wrist. And it is so hard to catch these people that if you are stupid enough to get caught doping, you should never be allowed to compete again.
It sounded like, you know, after 2009, you may have approached USSA about, you know, how do you look into or file an appeal or explore how you expose an athlete who might be doping?
I had a discussion with Luke Bodensteiner about it, and he told me in the conversation, he said, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me quoting, that as far as he's concerned, I earned a bronze medal in that race, and he would love to see me get it. And he explained all the red tape that would be involved in trying to reopen doping tests and everything else. And at the time, I was, you know, it was 2009. I was coming off a really good race, really good season. And I kind of took the attitude of, I don't want to put this much time and this much effort into it, because it would take away from my training and other goals in life. And I was, well, I'll win a medal and beat the dopers next time. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. But the process is pretty convoluted, and it would be a lot easier to tackle if it had been something for an Olympics rather than a world championship. I think it's harder to get stuff reopened for those.
What would be next for you after you're done in 2018?
Well, I want to finish my degree. I was studying psychology, and I also would like to continue work in diabetes advocacy. From a sports side, I'd be interested in maybe doing an Ironman triathlon or two. I enjoy doing triathlons in the summer. Right now, I'm pretty focused on skiing, and I'm, you know, still enjoying it.
I think your brother is 4 years older than you. Is that correct?
He is, yes.
I'm just curious what your relationship is like when it comes to competition.
We're extremely competitive, and I think, you know, and we tease each other, and, you know, if one wins, the other person gloats, and it's all in good-natured fun. I think sometimes it can be misread by some people looking at it, but, you know, we like training with each other. We both want each other to do well, and we both want to beat each other. Making jokes just makes light of the situation. My brother jokes that I've been so competitive with him that when I was, you know, one or two years old, the first thing I did when I stood up was I went over and punched him, and I tried to beat him up every single day until I succeeded when I was 19. So there's a lot of competitive rivalry between us, but at the same time, we both want to see each other do well.
Do you attribute some of your success to being able to chase someone who is 4 years older?
Coming up, I didn't have, you know, ideal coaching by any means all through grade school, junior high. You know, my dad was my coach, and he honestly he wasn't up on training theory or anything like that. The ski practice was you went out and you skied until it got dark, and then you got in the car and you drove home. So being able to chase someone 4 years older and stronger, and then later on have someone that was in a college program and actually had some training plans from, you know, from Becky Woods, I started to mimic that. So for sure, it was a big help.
What advice would you give yourself if you could go back to the start of your kind of elite level skiing career, which would be about 16 years ago? What would you tell yourself?
I think I would tell myself that I need to not be afraid of bad results and always race for the fun and the purity of the sport. And sometimes I would get really caught up in my results. And I think part of that was kind of being hit with my mortality, with the fact that I'm mortal, you know, and I was 20 years old and kind of having to come to terms with mortality right then. I started racing to prove to myself that I was still healthy and that I was still able to be one of the best in the world, rather than racing because it made me happy. And that's not a good place. If you're trying to prove something to yourself constantly, it can lead to some bad emotions when things don't go the way you want. And even when things go right, it's more of a release than fun. And I would definitely tell myself that you don't have to prove anything to yourself. You don't have to prove anything to the people around you. Just go out and race.
Did that mindset, like, wow, I'm racing for results, to kind of dispel this, like, my gosh, I am mortal, was that the vibe for most of those 16 years?
A lot of the time I was racing against myself, trying to make myself feel better about, you know, having a chronic disease and fearing not being one of the best in the world. And like I said, racing that way is not that effective. And I think it's only in the last several years that I've gotten past that. And it's a much healthier mind frame.
How does that look from someone who's just like, say, casually observing you?
Well, I'm never going to be able to take racing lightly, because I think that any serious athlete takes their racing really seriously, but you can't let it get tied up into your self-worth. And that's what I've changed. I have a bad race. I certainly don't enjoy it, and I do everything I can to avoid having another one. I no longer feel like the world's crumbling down around me. And I think you put you in a really bad mental place. I mean, when things are going well, everything's great. But then when things are bad, it's easy to get into kind of a depressed mindset about everything. And then it's hard to turn the corner.
Anything else?
I think it's worth mentioning that, a lot is made about the magic of the women's program and how I don't see it as a magical thing. I see a women's team that works really hard and races even harder. I think that they train amazingly well, and they train amazingly well together. I don't attribute their success to Magic Sox. I attribute their success to working really, really hard and working really well together. And I hope that happens on the guy side as well. I think that the guy's success has been overshadowed by the women. I think if the women weren't as successful right now, what the guys have done would shine through a little bit more. I mean, Simi's been on the podium a couple times. You go back a couple seasons ago, Hoff was actually credited with two World Cup wins, and that barely got any mention. I think, one, what the women are doing is really amazing, and I think that the guys will soon reach that level of success as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that actually, it's almost, and I think we all kind of follow, who report on the sport kind of fall into that trap. Is, and I can hear myself when you brought that up, I'm like, oh, I must have asked that question 15 times last year to the same person probably. But, that sort of magic cohesiveness, and who knows, that.
Well, whatever a person needs to motivate themselves to go out and train hard. I mean, if you need a great team around you and to be friends with everyone around you to go out and train really well, then that's what you should do. I like to use a camp I went to. I trained with Norway on a glacier three seasons ago. And I thought it was really interesting because, both the men's team and the women's team dominate the World Cup. And the women's team literally did everything together. They showed up at mealtimes together. They showed up at practice or training time at exactly the right time. They hardly separated into sprint and distance teams. They show up at the mealtimes again together, and they were always a group. The Norwegian guys, you'd show up for training at 9 o'clock like you were supposed to. Half of them might be there. Sundby would generally show up 40 minutes late, and then they'd all go off and ski on their own, and you could kind of follow them or go with them if you wanted to. And then everyone go back and shower, and guys would trickle in, eat real quick, and leave. And both of it worked. The women's team dominates, and they do it their way, and the guys' team has been very dominant, and they do it their way. So I don't think that there's just a universal way that it has to be done for both sexes or for all teams. I think finding your own way is the way to do it, and the women's team right now has found what works for them, and more power to them.
Well, thanks for your time, Chris.
No, you're welcome. Anytime.
Thanks for listening to Nordic Nation. And if you get a moment, feel free to leave a rating on the iTunes page. Thanks.